Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's the all-Canadian episode for Canada Day.
It is, all-Canadian. Yep. Break out the maple syrup. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Canada Day episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. This is episode...
Wait. You got to say it again. You were off mic. You got to start again.
I was off mic.
For the beginning. Then you cleared up towards the end.
Okay. I think I might have snorted in laughter. Actually,
yeah, again. No, I did.
This is 46.
You can cut that. No, you were talking like this, and then you said, and welcome to episode, or whatever.
Oh,
you said, welcome
okay,
to episode 34 of the Canada Day, like that.
Yeah, so. Okay. I follow you. Okay, hang on. I am pivoting in my seat. You are correct. Episode 46. Okay.
Wait. Is this going to be episode 46? Are you
it
sure?
It is, yes.
You're
yes,
sure?
Yeah, I'm positive.
All right.
Hey, Greg, stop interrupting him. He hates that.
I don't mind it. Okay. Hey, everybody. Welcome
Hey, Tim. How's it going?
Yeah, we had this before.
Yes, we did.
Hey, everybody.
Okay, we're good. Go ahead.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 46, the all-Canadian episode of More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell. I'm in Toronto, Ontario on this fine Canada Day. And I am joined by my co-host, Aaron Vey, in Whitby, Ontario.
Peace, order, and good government.
And I'm also joined by guest host today, Greg Hio, over there in over by the Eaton Centre in Toronto.
Hello, everyone, eh?
Hey.
Oh, good one.
Good job, eh? Yeah, so take off, and yeah, this is the Canada Day episode. Jaime and Mark are too busy.
Too busy.
Once again, to make a podcast.
So Mark is launching today.
Apparently, yeah. So he said he'll either be, you know, drowning his sorrows or totally wasted getting on a plane.
I am delighted for it. I hope it works.
It is launch day for many people, I guess, which we'll get into later in the episode.
Yeah.
Edit here.
I had my poutine. I did not have Swiss Chalet, though. That sounded
well,
good.
Well, yeah. Then I got you both beat because I had Swiss Chalet poutine for dinner tonight.
Oh, whoa, there you go. I didn't know they didn't even know it was on the menu.
Oh, wow. It is, baby. I had it with the club wrap. It was great.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I guess you get the fries with the...
Yeah, you get fries with it, but then for an extra $2, you can upgrade to poutine.
Okay, but is my problem with poutine that I've had is the gravy. It's like
do they use that Swiss Chalet gravy or is it something else?
Oh no, they've got their own. It's a decent gravy.
Is it meaty, like, or is it chickeny gravy, or?
Yeah, it's a little more, you know, like, is it a chicken gravy? No, it's not a chicken gravy as you might think of it. Like, it's not light brown. You know, it's darker.
Okay.
It looks like a beef gravy, even though those guys produce chicken like you would not believe.
Yeah, well, they do ribs there too. But the my problem with poutine is I mean I really don't go looking for it, but I've never really found one that in my mind had the right kind of, you know, dark beefy gravy kind of thing. You know, so
they seem to lean that way.
Yeah,
you know, okay. And I quite liked it. You know, it's obviously it's not the best poutine you're ever gonna have. Clearly.
No, but the potatoes are good at Swiss Chalet, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, I like their fries.
They got that whole Harvey's thing going there, right? So
Yeah.
You should go there. Have you been to Hero Burger, Tim?
I actually went to Hero Burger the other day.
Did you have their
first
poutine?
Time. No, but I had their hamburgers. Interesting wrapping
they do have interesting wrapping.
Yeah, so it was my first time at a Hero Burger. Okay.
Do they have good poutine? They do have poutine. I mean, they've had fries with gravy for a long time, as far as I remember. But I do like their gravy, so I think their poutine works. It is a dark kind of beefy gravy, so you should try this. I sure hope this is going in the show. You should try their poutine.
I'm sure Daryl will have lots of questions for us on this live group, you know?
Okay.
I've been spoiled because we used to have an Eaton store when I lived in St. Catharines, and that's when I first discovered fries and gravy, and the gravy was that dark, beefy gravy, and, you know, so I'm a bit picky about that. And also, I had a chocolate mousse once on St. Catharines Street in Montreal, and I've never been able to satisfy myself with another good chocolate mousse, but there you go.
Huh.
Yeah, pretty big. And the best coffee I ever had was somewhere in the south of France. You know, it was just turned me off of putting milk in coffee, and it was. Let's put it this way: when you get a coffee or an espresso in France, they give you a little piece of chocolate with it, right? And this coffee was so good, it was better than the chocolate. So,
wow.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
You'll be chasing it for the rest of your life.
I will be chasing it for. Sadly, I will. That's why I can't go back to Tim Hortons. I'm sorry.
I don't know. You know that my plans were kind of up in the air, obviously, because I didn't think I would be able to do this tonight. I thought I'd be up at the cottage by now. But our plans changed, and so I'm here. And knowing that I was going to be here now for the rest of the week and going up on Friday, I decided to launch Magpie today and just get it out there. I didn't really want to launch it and then go away, I guess. You know, that's the idea, in case anything untoward occurred. The other motivation is that I wanted to give the press contacts that I'd contacted time to perhaps show some interest in Magpie and maybe write a review or at least some news about it when it launched. And that yielded exactly zero response. So I just said, heck with it. Let's just go ahead anyway. And Apple sent me an email saying, look, you've been having this thing ready for sale for a month. What's your problem? so, yeah, let's just go ahead and launch it. And so I did. I launched it. I pushed the button tonight, and within a few minutes, it was live on the store. It was propagating out. I still don't see it in the search engine results, of course, but I think a direct link will take you there. Certainly, by the time this show airs, it'll be easily findable, I should think.
Well, I want to say congratulations and also ask,
thanks.
What kind of stats do you get from the CloudKit backend thing? Can you look at that and see signups?
No.
And I forget what kind of things you're storing in there.
Nothing. So the way Magpie works anyway, the way CloudKit works is it has public and private databases, right? So the public database would be for, if you can imagine, like a social application where all users of the app would be contributing data to it and it would be publicly visible to all the users. Mm-hmm. Think of like maybe an auction app or something or some kind of social application. But Magpie uses the private database. So that's stored on every individual's private iCloud user account. I have zero visibility into that. So there's no way that I can see how much Magpie is being utilized. The only signal that I know of right now, I mean, other than, you know, the reports that I'm going to get from iTunes, obviously, is that, you know, when you share a video on Magpie, the say on Twitter, for example, it adds the via Magpie video tag to it, which you could, of course, delete. But I've already seen one of those tonight. So,
probably.
Yeah, I know there's at least one user out there right now.
Okay.
Yep. So that's basically what it comes down to. I mean, the reason I said it's bittersweet, of course, is that... you know, I was hoping it would launch with a little more fanfare, and mm-hmm. it of course didn't, because you know, it's the problem that we talk about again and again and again, is that, you know, nobody cares. it's a new app, and nobody really has time for it, and even the people I gave it to for free haven't used it. And
right.
I tried to give away copies last week. You know, we talked about it on the show that will never air.
It might air.
Okay, well,
it'll be a lost episode.
It wouldn't have mattered anyway.
No, not for
by
that.
By the time it it had launched the contest thing, you would have been over anyway. So
quite right, yeah. You know, having said that, like what I'm referring to a conversation that no user or listener of our podcast is going to hear. The point being that
nasty.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm just, you know, we talked about this last week, but. Okay, anyway.
Yeah, it will see the light of day, trust me.
All right, it doesn't have to at this point. It feels kind of redundant. But anyway, last week we talked about that contest that I held, and the idea was that anybody who tweeted a link to the contest page would be eligible to win a copy of the pre-release version of Magpie. You know, so like the version that was on the store, ready to go, but which was not yet available for sale. I was able to give away promo codes. And I got zero, like, you responded, Tim, at the time. Like, as we were recording, you did a tweet, or several tweets.
Yeah. And but I think Jaime also...
I think he retweeted one of yours, and that was it. Zero else. So, and you guys already had access to the app. Greg, I should have sent you one. Damn. Sorry. I'll get
on. I'm copy. I'm waiting for the bundle. I was going to ask you about that later, but sorry, go ahead.
Anyway, so... zero response, and so I thought, okay, you can't even give this thing away, so let's put it up for sale for $4.99. And that's my plan, and that's what I'm doing, and so it's done. And I don't know, it's not much is going to happen to it. So that's why it's bittersweet. It's because, you know, I've been working on this for a long time. I think it's a very good app. It's a useful app. I use it every day. I cannot say that about very many apps. But nobody's going to have time to find that out, and that's the big problem. So it goes back to the strategy that we've talked about again and again, that the big bang marketing and the hit-driven nature of the App Store is not the kind of work that I'm planning to do here. This app is going to go out there. It's going to putter along. It might make a sale a week. It might make two sales a week. Who knows? But because it's useful to me and because I believe in it, I'm going to continue working on it. And eventually it's going to become so good that the right people will start to notice it and talk about it. And hopefully maybe 3-4 years from now, it'll actually be worth something. I don't know if there's any other way to it because, you know, there's I don't have the resources to market it in a very effective way. And I don't have the skill set to do that either. Even if I did have the resources. I think that's the battle I'm up against, you know, like I could, you know, have put all my resources in one basket and done some kind of big launch plan with PR and marketing and advertising and done like 200 sales on day one and then watch that long tail taper off. But that's not what I'm doing here. That's not what I believe in. You know, this app is going to be here to stay, and it's going to continue developing. And so the people who bought it today, you know, all one or two of them, will they're going to get the most value out of it because it's going to continue improving over time. Like it's not going to remain stagnant, many iOS apps do.
How much are you selling it for?
$4.99 on both platforms, iOS and Mac.
Okay.
Is it possible to do a cross-platform bundle where you can buy the Mac and the iOS? No.
No.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think you'll find that you know, in my experience, that the selling of apps is sort of it's a long tail proposition, right? Like, you know, either you're going to get some people initially right off the bat, but over time, it's going to take a while for people to sort of find it. And I think you just got to hang in there because, I mean, the reality is everybody kind of wants free stuff. And you know, we've all had the race for the bottom, which has made everybody think that apps should be free. And, you know, people like Aaron shouldn't make a living doing it. But the reality is you need to do that. And I think over time you'll find that, you know, it'll trickle out and you'll get it out there. But I think you have to keep talking about it, have to keep tweeting about it, have to keep, you know, keep it in the public eye. We'll keep talking about it on the podcast, you know, that kind of thing. Over time it'll eventually grow. I mean, you're the number one client for it right now, as you said, right? You're the number one user. You mentioned that last week as well, right? You said you were using the heck out of it, if I remember correctly, and I think over time it'll grow. I mean, it's, you know, it's not going to take on the Photoshops of the world, but I think as shareware goes, or whatever you want to call it, it'll do well eventually. You know.
Yeah, I think it's just consistency. You know, that's the only thing that matters. It's the only thing. It's the only resource that I can bring to bear on it. Is just a long time continuing to build on it.
And I think, like I said, over time, I think a market will grow for it, you know, sort of thing. Like it's not a every man's app sort of thing. If it was, it would be the monetary model would be different, right? We've talked about that on the show before. Like if you have an app that's, you know, specifically for a niche type of market, you know, you're not going to get everybody and his brother downloading it just for the sake of downloading it, right? You don't want the people who are going to download it, look at it, use it for 5 minutes, and then forget they downloaded it. You know, that's not your audience either, right?
Yeah.
You want the people who have a need, you know, like you said, to, you know, want to watch these videos, don't have time for it right now because they're, you know, at work or whatever, save it for later. Sort of like the Instapaper for video, right?
That's exactly the term I'm using for it.
Yeah. That sounds awfully familiar, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Well, that's the model that he talked about last week on the show that may or may not see the light of day.
I never heard this episode. There are some links in the document about businessy stuff, but I was wondering, I don't remember, but have you guys talked about the technical side of Magpie in previous episodes? Is that something you'd be willing to talk about?
In the last episode, we did.
Go ahead, dig into it.
Well, I don't know, Tim. Like, do you want to decide whether this is going to happen or
just,
and if
go
not,
for
should
it,
we
Eric.
Go do it over again?
It doesn't matter. You got it. Marketing. Tell them again.
Well,
it,
you know,
takes 11 touches before somebody really realizes that they need your product, right? So
yeah, I'm just
three
imagining
times and it's yours.
I'm just imagining.
Well, let me just ask
our...
you because I'm just
go
curious
ahead.
About it. Then
yeah.
I guess I was wondering about a few things, cross-platform stuff and CloudKit stuff. But I was wondering for CloudKit how you found the testing aspect of it. And a lot of people said, again, with the public side, maybe I'm thinking CloudKit dashboard, but how did you find the testing of that? I imagine there's some kind of sandbox CloudKit that you had to use and test things out, but how did you find the CloudKit integration in terms of testing things?
Was actually not that difficult. That was one of the easier things because the framework is actually very good, very easy to work with. CloudKit has a development and a production environment when you're building with it. So as I was working to create the app, I was working in the development environment, obviously. But whenever you ship a version of the app through the App Store or through TestFlight, it would automatically rig it to the production environment. And so anybody that was testing it and then used one of these TestFlight or downloads from the App Store would have a different collection, right? Because it's using a different database altogether. Mm-hmm. Having said that, though, like using that development environment and then having that web-based dashboard to help you configure the data objects, and I try to keep that really simple. It's not terribly complicated from a data model perspective. It's just basically like a single video object that you save, you know, and you save as many as you like, but they have a fairly defined structure. I think the toughest part of working with CloudKit was dealing with the notifications. So the push notifications that come through whenever a change occurs to your data set. Mm-hmm. When that happens, you've got to configure your app to receive a push notification and to act accordingly. And you have to create a subscription for each type of notification, add, delete, and update. Mm-hmm. So for each of those, you have to have a subscription, a CK subscription object set up and saved to your CloudKit database. And it took a long time for me to figure that out. And I was actually just corresponding with someone on Twitter this week and who was having the same problem. He's like, how the heck does this stuff even work? Because it's really not very well documented.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there was a ton of trial and error involved, a little bit of Stack Overflow. There's one fellow there, you know, and this is, I'm thinking like 8 months ago now, so I don't know anyone's names anymore. But there was one fellow on Stack Overflow that was just going around answering CloudKit subscription questions. I wondered if he worked for Apple or not. but he was enormously helpful in helping me figure that out. Like, other than that, though, it was very straightforward. Like pulling data from CloudKit, saving to CloudKit, updating CloudKit, deleting items from CloudKit, no problem at all. Super easy. Makes total sense. You get two devices going side by side, you know, your Mac on this side and then your iPad over here, and you just do something over on your iPad and it reflects on the Mac within 5 seconds. And, you know, you just keep doing that back and forth, and you just stop worrying about that. So it's just a terrific service. It works very well.
Was it a little more core data-ish? I'm just curious about, since you're storing videos, was it sort of more document in the cloud the way you were using it?
No, I'm not actually storing the video files themselves. I'm storing just metadata. So a video record for Magpie consists of like the name of the video. So that just comes from the title of the page. The thumbnail, a link to the thumbnail image for the video. And then I save like three different video URLs. And so those URLs then stream the video to the player in Magpie when you're going to view a video. And that's, you know, and then some other metadata that I need, but that's about it. And it's really straightforward. There's probably like 10 attributes on the video object that I currently have. So it's not that complicated.
Cool. Okay. If you had a choice between, I forget if we've talked about this before too, like CloudKit local as the core data replacement, how far do you think truth line that is?
No. My initial approach actually was to treat CloudKit like I would like an application server. And, you know, like imagine yourself setting up a collection view, okay? And you want a data source for the collection view. And so what you do is, you branch off to a background thread, you call the endpoint, pull down some JSON, and then populate the collection view. And you might have a local cache, right? So that was sort of the approach I initially took with CloudKit, but CloudKit's not fast enough to do that. You know, or an application server might respond within, 500 milliseconds, say. You'd be waiting several seconds for CloudKit to come back to you with the data set. And so it's not really like that at all. And so instead, what I have to do is rely much more heavily on a local disk-based cache that I create. And I ended up not using core data. I find core data so complex, especially when I'm dealing with just one data object, it would be one managed object, which no relationships, nothing like that. It's just overkill in so many circumstances. Confusing CloudKit and core data, which is ridiculous, but core data just feels like overkill in so many situations. I'm generally not a fan of core data. I'm just going to put it out there. I'm sorry, but there it is. I'm not a huge fan of it. I'd rather use SQLite. I guess it must be my web background showing itself because I understand it so well that I feel like that solves all my problems that I ever need. But everyone's got different opinions on that.
And you can call the database without feeling bad about yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you using raw SQLite C calls, or were you using one of those wrappers around it?
Yeah, FMDB.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I've got quite a bit of experience with FMDB, so it's what I tend to use. Mm-hmm. What I ended up doing is just, do an initial call, of course. You got to get the data at some point. but then, rely on that cache data from disk, and then update it with the CloudKit every time I get the chance to do so. Just a slight tweak on how you manage the data model. Okay. But you've got to rely on the local disk rather than on CloudKit. It's just not responsive enough.
Now you mentioned push notifications as well. For example, if you added something on the Mac and then it shows up on the iOS side, is that an actual push that's visible, or is it one of those silent push notifications that just phones the server in the background and fetches the new CloudKit record and updates the local database? Is that how it works?
Yeah, it's a CK subscription object. So this is a CloudKit thing. It's part of the framework. And so these subscriptions take the form of these silent push notifications. I'm trying to remember the mechanism, whether the notification itself contains the change set or if it's just a signal for me to go and update the change set.
I feel like it's just the signal because the payload size is pretty small, right?
It's bigger now,
but yeah, that's what I imagine.
Yeah. Anyway, like whenever those notifications come in, then the app updates itself and does the same thing. Like it'll go and get the state of the database, update the local store, and then update the UI to show it. All in all, I mean, I find that it works very well. It's pretty efficient. I've had no complaints about it from any of my testers so far. I'm pretty happy with it.
And now, since you do have a Mac and an iOS version, first curiosity question is, how much shared code would you say is between the two? And is it a single Xcode project, or do you have two Xcode projects?
Yeah. it's actually a single project, and it takes advantage of the frameworks support that we had in iOS coming in iOS 8. So once we were able to build shared frameworks in there, I was able to create a single video. The project was called Video Grabber when it started out. I created a Video Grabber kit, and I created a Mac version and an iOS version. So there were two targets, one for each of those kits, a target for each of iOS and Mac, the application, and then a target for the share extensions, which allow the user to save to Magpie from other outside of the Magpie application, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're in Twitter on your iPhone and you want to save a video, you can use the action extension in your Twitter app to do that, and that's a separate target in the Xcode project.
Okay.
Now, one of the challenges, of course, when building a cross-platform setup like this is that, most of my application code that does all the background work, like saving the videos, saving to CloudKit, talking to CloudKit, the data, moving it back and forth from the local to the cloud and back, all that stuff is shared code. And there was one particular, using images in particular was kind of a pickle. Because, having images in the shared code, you've got NSImage on the Mac in AppKit, and you've got UIImage in UIKit. Mm-hmm. But they're almost identical in terms of their API. Mm-hmm. So I created an XImage class, which inherits from either of those image classes depending on what platform it's on.
Yeah.
So I was able to call XImage instead of UIImage or NSImage. And then I had this subclass that was able to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And then it was funny because I'd come up with that solution, and then I saw a video from WWDC not too long after that where Apple was talking about how they developed their pages or, iWork apps, right? Yeah. And they did a sort of similar thing. So...
there's a lot of talk about the UX kit for the Photos app, but I've heard the same thing used in cross-platform SpriteKit games, where, same thing. This is in Swift, but you can still have those if OS is Mac or if OS is iOS, you just kind of... This solution I saw, this is for maybe Swift specific, but it would kind of type def like my image as either NSImage or UIImage, and then you just have to be careful to call only the properties and methods that exist on both sides, but you went for the subclass where you kind of wrapped it and said if it's on, like if I call the property size, maybe on UI image it's called size, but on NS image it's called like image size or something, but you would kind of massage that out on your subclass to do the right thing and split the code path in two ways. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I never had to get to that level, fortunately. I was using methods on NSImage, UIImage that were common between the two of them, so it was never an issue. In Objective-C, anyway, it's like an ifdef. So ifdef target OS iPhone or target iPhone simulator, and then I know I'm using iOS, and then else I'm going to bring in Cocoa. So...
But there was no built-in anything to do that. As you mentioned, the pages, the iWork guys said they had to build something themselves, but that's not something that's available to the rest of us.
Correct. But it's so simple. I mean, there's nothing to it. Like, your implementation file is actually empty. And your header file, basically, you have to import something called target conditionals header. Mm-hmm. This is something that, I guess it's part of the frameworks that allows you to use these ifdef statements. And then you just basically wrap the import statements around them.
What's the lowest version of OS X that is, what's the requirement?
I built this on 10.10. Was it? Yes, 10.10. So I was planning to launch with 10.10 support, which is Yosemite, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. I just get my damn numbers straight, but Yosemite. So I was going to launch for Yosemite, as well as iOS 8, and here we are now. I've launched, and so anybody that's using the current stuff will have it. And then come September, when iOS 9 and 10.11 launch, I'll be supporting two versions of the operating systems.
Did you consider going back to 10.9 and supporting Mavericks as well, and maybe iOS 7, or was there something in the code base that requires 10.10 or iOS 8 that you really wanted to use?
Definitely with, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but this framework capability that I have now in Xcode 6.
Yeah, as soon as you said that, I thought, I think that's iOS 8. I don't know whether this is on the Mac.
That's definitely iOS 8 only. And you know, the Mac has had shared frameworks for a long, long time. So I'm not sure if it's as much of an issue there. I'm really just for simplicity's sake, and I know the adoption numbers are really good. If I hear of anybody that's saying, oh, I'd use your app, except, you know, I'm on, you know, Mavericks or Snow Leopard or something, and then, you know, I might just have a good laugh. I don't know, but we'd have to see.
And so here's the, so did you write the whole app in Objective-C, or is there some Swift in there?
There
or?
Is zero Swift in here.
Zero Swift.
Yeah, well, you know my position on Swift, right? Like, it needs to grow up.
Well, your position changed a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, yes, it did.
After WWDC, you thought maybe you might be looking at some of that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at least for present, Magpie is going to continue to be 100% Objective-C. I know that you can share the code between the two, and I get that. But I think I'll save, you know, whatever my next project is, I'll write in it in Swift, but... Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep this in Objective-C for now.
Cool. All righty. I put something up here, a senior developer from Matt Briggs.
I really like that article. I was going to put that there myself.
Were you? Okay, good. And then and you put one about a couple of articles, sad articles about the indie app business.
No, that'll tie right into Magpie.
I was just, that's why I was hoping to make this the Magpie special. Yeah, there was Brent Simmons and then this other gentleman, Curtis Herbert, and then there was another post I just saw, which I think Brent Simmons retweeted. There's another one from Alan Pike that he just sort of retweeted, reposted, whatever the word is for re-putting something on your blog. Mm-hmm. It's just one more kind of thing. They're all kind of similar kind of idea, but I thought Aaron would have things to say about it.
About Brent Simmons's. Yeah, he's just basically saying, you know what, it's tough to make an app because nobody cares. But we do it out of love, hence the title. You know, keep it up.
Yeah, and that's kind of sort of what I was saying, I think, 3 or 4 weeks ago when we talked about this before, why build apps that I know aren't going to do anything? It's because I like building apps, right? So, and I like putting my ideas out there and that imaginary, you know, audience that you have out there somewhere, right?
Well, I saw it as a good splash of cold water, throwing a bucket of cold water on someone as well, because there tends to be this, I guess, as the title suggests, do what you love, and you just have to stick with it. And I guess there was a little bit, because Brent has been doing this for a while, of this sort of back in the old days when indie Mac developers could thrive and have these apps that they loved, and people would pay $50 a unit for them, and it was great. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like, hey, snap out of it. It's not the Mac days. That will probably not happen, and we just need to adjust our thinking a little bit. There will still be indie developers on iOS platform and on the Mac and everywhere else, but it's one of those, you know, not everyone can be a movie star kind of posts. Unless I put the word sad in quotation marks, but I think it was just a nice... It's not going to be like the way it was. It's going to be different. That doesn't mean that there are no indie developers and that we can't do it. It's just, it's hard work. It's always been hard work. It's like, it's not like back in the old days, anyone could just throw an app together and make a living. It's like, it was difficult back then and it's still difficult now. And maybe we've just romanticized the past a little too much. And, you know, that's just not the way to think about it. And I think one of the follow-up articles was really good because it was like, it's not a bad thing, because having all these people writing apps, like Aaron, writing apps that they really want to use and that they really enjoy, that's not a bad thing. That's maybe not adding to the economy, if that's the right way to say it. It's not bringing like money into a lot of people's pockets, but it's just bringing good software out in the world, which you could say has its own, this is the fuzzy moment of the show. It has its own value, right?
No, for sure. And I totally agree that you know, there's if you build something that you're passionate about or you think is a need that people have, it's more about the building of the tool and the creating the opportunity to help people with your software rather than it is about making the almighty buck. I mean, and that's the problem with app development is the general public takes a while to catch up to the idea that, hey, there's an app for that. By the time they catch up with that idea and they all think they've got the $1 million idea, that ship has already sailed, right? You know, because they're, like I said, they're coming late to the party. So, but those of us who build software, whether it's just, you know, little, you know, trinkety websites or or little apps. Like, I built an app about Canadians. Like, today's Canada Day, so, you know, people should be playing Geese Squad because it's all about Canada. It's got, you know, butter tarts in there and blueberries and, you know, evil American hunters and golfers and stuff like that. And American Eagle comes by and steals your geese buddies, you know. But we only built that because we just wanted to build something that talked about a lot of Canadian ideas and sort of the idea. And, like, even to the point where my wife made me remove the American hunters because they had guns and switch it over to kids with slingshots. I mean, the reality is I didn't build that app to make, you know, copious amounts of money. I built that app to go through the whole process of building an app and, you know, setting up, you know, working with Game Center and looking at different font art and, you know, working with it was Cocos 2DS at the time, you know, and I'm actually going to do a version of it for with SpriteKit, you know, and maybe with the new gameplay kit utilities that are available to us now in iOS 9, I might even use some of those, you know, and so my geese will have lasers to be able to fire at those evil golfers, you know. So
as long as there's flocking, there's got to be a flocking reference.
Well, that's
in there somewhere.
What I'm getting at, because the whole mechanism is you're creating a chevron of geese, and we mathematically make a linked list, and they flock together down the road, right? But I built that app because my grandsons and I were, you know, we were just riffing one day. They were young. They were like, you know, 8 or 9 or something like that at the time. And they just thought it'd be fun to build this app. And then I had my friend's kids record their voices for the sounds for each goose does a little honk. It's all a little, you know, some little friend of mine. You know, and they're pumped about the fact that they're in an app. It's not about, you know, yeah, it'd be great if I could make money. Or I was actually featured by the Apple Store at one point, but they, you know, now that I'm not using all the fancy, you know, UI dynamics and all that kind of stuff, you know, I've fallen out of favor with Apple. But still, you know, the purpose of building that app was just out of passion, just because I was going through the process of learning the new tools and wanted to build something that people would enjoy, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not about making money. It'd be nice, but, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, like, the problem is that so many people enter this business with the notion that there's going to be some recompense for the effort that they've expended to make this app, you know?
Yeah, no,
like, nobody knows the kind of effort it takes to make an app.
Yeah, and they're surprised when we tell them. Like, when we tell them it's this amount of effort, and you translate it into hours and translate it into dollars, it's, you know, they go like, oh my God, I can't believe it's that much. And it does take a lot of effort. And we were talking about this on a show many months ago on the, I think episode 12 was the iPad episode, right, where we talked about last year when size classes came out. And the fact that people don't realize what amount of effort it takes to build an iPad app, to build a good one. I mean, like, that takes advantage of the whole platform and the size and the real estate and all that, right? So,
yeah, you know, and one of the things I think needs to be repeated about Brent's column, and I just want to, yes, here, can I read from the Book of Brent?
just so we didn't really introduce this, but we're talking about a post by Brent Simmons on theessential.com called Love, and it's about the love of making apps, and the follow-up article by Kurdish, I'm not sure who that person, follow-up one is called Tub Love. We'll put links in the show. But go ahead, Aaron, read your piece.
It's Curtis Herbert.
Thank you.
No problem. You know, when Greg was saying that there's, you know, it's a good thing in a way that people do this out of love, because the passion gets into the app and, you know, a lot of people get to enjoy great software. The other side of it, though, and the side that I bemoan, is the fact that the economics of the App Store are such that, you know, a lot of great developers tend not to make apps for iOS because it's just, they know it's not going to be worthwhile. And that's what Brent is talking about here. So, if I estimate the number of iOS apps in the App Store and get the difference between the estimate and the actual number, that difference will be larger than the number of successful apps, he writes, which is to say that there are a ton of apps, way too many. Mm. And he defines success as that making enough profit to make it worth continuing to work on the app, which is a calculation that I've made and have determined that, you know, the money will not be the impetus for me to continue working on the app. It has to be out of my own passion. Now, do any developers doubt I'm right? He writes. And when developers think this way, they take their app ideas and toss them aside. Quote, hey, you know what? This idea would be really great for iPad. Darn. Unquote. Quote, this would be perfect for iPhone. Oh, well. Unquote. See, that's what happens all the time, you know? When I was considering what to build next myself before I decided on Magpie, I had several ideas, bigger ideas than Magpie, mm-hmm. that I even got started on, but then stopped because, you know, the amount of effort was just too much for the almost certain failure that I would experience. And so your sight's lower as a developer, especially as an independent developer. Like, you just cannot tackle too much because there's simply no way that you can justify the amount of risk, the amount of effort for what will be a pebble in the ocean. And that, I think, damages the entire platform. Not that anyone cares.
Yeah, well, I think we care and our listeners care, but
there it is. I think the new model is going to be, which I hear a lot of people are doing, is you just have your regular day job and then you do apps in the evening, and then if you break out of, I mean, it's a hard cycle to go through because the idea is, do you want to quit your job? Is that even a goal? Like, maybe some people don't even want to quit their jobs and take on the risk anymore. But then what happens if your app had a runaway success? Then do you quit your job and then work on your now successful indie project afterwards? I think there's a shift where before it was like, no, I'm going to quit my job and work on this for a year, and then it'll be successful, and then this is going to be my livelihood from now on. Whereas these days, people are more, I'm going to work on this. They seem resigned almost to the fact that, no, I'm just going to work on this in my spare time. I'll release it. Maybe I'll get a few sales. And even if it took off and I got $100, $200, $500, even $1,000 a month from it, no, that's like still a side project. And then you're like, are you ever going to take it, quote unquote, seriously? And you know, maybe more quotes, take it to the next level and evolve the product. And I guess that would be my worry, is that as much, as Aaron said, as much love and passion goes into these apps and it'll show through, I feel like we're just going to have a bunch of very well-crafted apps that are still treated as hobbies, which, not to, again, denigrate the effort or anything like that, but it's just different. Again, Brett cites places like Panic and, you know, the Omni Group, and I just feel like you're never going to reach that level, and there's going to be this giant stratification of, you know, top, like OmniFocus or OmniGraffle or something like that, and then a very well-crafted app like Magpie even, but that just, I don't know. Aaron, what would be sort of your end game, you know, wish from the genie kind of situation out of, let's say, just Magpie specifically?
Well, ever since I started as a developer in iOS, I've always wanted to be independent and make a living off of my own apps. I much prefer living under my own recognizance than working for other people as a consultant, but that's what I have to do to make my money, you know? Like, I have to work for the companies, and it's not a terrible hardship. Let me hasten to add that. Like, I'm doing very well at that business. And, you know, like Justin Williams, in response to this very article on Twitter from Brent Simmons, said, you know, I'm working for several clients as a consultant. I'm making more money now than I ever did when I was selling my own apps exclusively, and I still get my afternoon naps. Come at me, haters. you know, which, you know, like, there's definitely something to be said for that. You know, and I agree, you know, like, that living the consultant life can be, assuming, giant asterisk, if you have the right client, can be very good. But yeah, like, I definitely would love to be able to work on Magpie and whatever other, you know, whatever the next app is, full time, you know, and if Magpie were so successful that I could, you know, maybe hire someone to work with me, like, get a developer, get a designer, and then, you know, really polish it to a fine sheen, you know, and then build services around it, and then, you know, start thinking of new breakthrough features, and then work on a second app, you know, that, you know, would really, you know, something much more mainstream, perhaps, so that, you know, you can take on bigger tasks, you know, but it all requires money, and that's something that you can't do unless you win this lottery.
Yeah, and that's actually what the missing thought I had was, I've been talking to a lot of developers, and I've been reading a lot of stuff, and maybe one of these articles might have pointed it out, and that does seem to be the type of style of developer that we have out there now, is that you know, you have the Omnis and the Agile Bits and stuff like that who do their make their products out of passion and out of love, right? And the rest of us do too. I mean, I went to a bunch of conferences in 2010, 2011, and met a lot of developers who were early in the game, but it seemed to be they were building apps because they were passionate about building apps per se. They weren't in a gold rush mentality, that kind of stuff. You know, the Mike Lees and kind of that stuff were there. But it seems to me that the reality is you need to have a day job to work, you know, either as a consultant or work for a studio that builds apps and makes money building apps for other businesses. Because as an independent person, you really can't, unless you have some earth-shattering idea, you know, you're not going to be really out there making a ton of money off of an app. And you know, if it does take off and starts to build, then the question is, are you now an app builder, or are you now a product manager, because you're now working on, like, let's imagine Magpie took off for the sake of exercise, right? You know, and it became like everybody had to, you know, Justin Bieber said you have to have Magpie, and, you know, everybody started downloading Magpie, and all of a sudden you needed to look at, you know, upgrading your servers and, like you said, hiring a staff to support it, and then you had to, you know, get some support people to actually answer the calls when they came in. You know, if you can imagine, like, Agile Bits, you know, with their product 1Password went from, like, you know, a couple of people building to a team of 40 or so people, right? And it becomes a business, and it's no longer, you know, hey, I get to put this button on the screen and connect it to my action. You know, now I have to, you know, I don't get to do that anymore, because now I'm Aaron Vey, the CTO of this mega corporation, right?
Yeah, I hope it. I would not want it to get that big. You know, like I really admire Agile Bits as a company. But they're much larger than I would ever want to be involved in terms of that. Not that there's any danger of it, but. You know, like, I look around the industry and I look at the people that do succeed in companies like Flexibits, the makers of Fantastical. That's two guys.
Yeah.
You know, we think of Gus Mueller, maker of Acorn. He's the flying meat guy. Dan Jalkut, Marzetti, he's a single guy by himself. Yeah. You know, I think he's making a modest living, but, sure. You know, like, that's the sort of thing that I really... look to when I try to gauge success. You know, is could I justify doing this as a full-time gig? Could I be big enough to hire one or two other people? But not, you know, Agile Bits is like 40 people.
Yeah
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's no, and at 40 people, it's no longer for Rustem and Davis, I forgot, is the other owner, Dave.
Dave and Rustem. Yeah.
Their I mean, their day is now, you know, dealing with issues bigger than like I was saying about building apps or even being able to come up with another idea, because now they have to. They're always sort of keeping the ball rolling with 1Password. It's an awesome app. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's one of my favorite apps. You know, that it would be
first like thing I installed on my new iMac last night.
It would be my pick every week. I use it on every computer and every iOS device I have, and I tell people about it all the time. Right.
Yep.
But you know, I don't envy them that position. I mean, I do envy them that position, but I don't envy them the position of having to support that one product. It probably would drive me crazy eventually, right? So
it might.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to find out, though, personally.
Yeah, I know. It would be nice to have those kind of problems, right?
Yeah. Definitely. I know Dave Tier, the one of the founders, and I think both Rustem as well. I think they both still code, you know, and that's...
Yeah.
You know, I don't think they code as often as they'd like, but they still do.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to talk about this post by Matt Briggs about the role of senior developer, looking at how, the outside industry measures a developer in terms of years of experience versus what they actually know and what they can actually do, right? You know, juniors we consider as, you know, being somebody just out of school a couple of years. And you would assume that they wouldn't have sort of big picture vision. And feel free to jump in anytime, guys.
Now I'm going to let you dangle.
I was going to let you finish.
It sounds like you were doing just a fine job there.
Call this up here. Hang on. Yeah, so it goes through defining what a junior developer is, and, you know, how we all grow as developers and that kind of stuff. And then, you know, talks a bit more about how an intermediate developer is, you know, it's 3 to 4 years, that kind of stuff, and what criteria makes somebody a senior developer, right? So, you know, the is it 3 to 4 years, 5 years?
No, hang on. You know, like, actually what he's saying is that it has nothing to do with the number of years.
No, that's what I'm saying. But that's what I'm saying. Like, when a headhunter calls you and you say, oh, I've been doing this for 5 years, they're like, oh, yeah, then we're going to put you in a senior developer role and blah, 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 right?
Right, right.
And yeah, my point is that, you know, if I was to measure the four of us, right, with that sort of scale, yeah, we've all been doing this about the same amount of time, right? But Mark is head and shoulders above me, for sure. Right, Aaron, you have you're above me in other ways, and Greg, you're above me, way above me in terms of Swift and that kind of stuff. And you, the two of you are very sort of what's the word I'm looking for?
No idea.
Is it erudite? You're able to talk about the technologies, and you're able to carry on high level conversations about, you know, the various pieces, bits and pieces that go into building apps, right? I'm more on the UI side, so I tend to, you know, look at, you know, user interface things and design, and I spend time in Photoshop and that kind of stuff, right? So, you know, I'm less likely to do the heavy lifting when it comes to, you know, laying out a core data database, or, I mean, I can do it, don't get me wrong, and I do it all the time, but you know, when it comes to heavy lifting and architecting or designing what design pattern we're going to go within an app, that's not sort of my shtick. I don't really get into that. I don't have a passion for that. So, you know, but that, does that make me any less of a senior or intermediate developer than you guys, right? So, because the thing about it is that every developer brings a different set of skills to the table in terms of life experience and in terms of where they've gone and what they've studied, and, you know, what they've learned, right, through the world, you know? Where the three of us are all self-taught, I believe, right, Greg?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, and you've come at it from Perl, and Aaron's come at it from Ruby, and I've come at it from, you know, other kinds of scripting like PHP and MySQL and all that kind of stuff, and come at it. We've all done we've all paid our penance building websites, you know. You know, but it brings us to a different place, you know. You know, I've worked with Perl. I didn't enjoy it. I worked with Ruby. I was early when I worked on Ruby, so I really didn't see the value in it at that time. That was 15 years ago, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But, I mean, so when you measure what a senior developer is, it's not just in terms of... It actually is in terms of time put into the craft, but that it is a certain level of time that needs to be put in there, right? And I think that's what this article is talking about, the fact that you can't just measure somebody by the amount of time they've put into the position, right?
It is quality, not quantity,
yeah,
that counts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. I really like the sort of framing device, if you can call it that, in this article, mm-hmm. where if you kind of read it backwards, the key line for me is, if you do not have at least one senior developer in a leadership role in your team, your project is doomed to fail. And at that point, again, this is the end of the article, but if you read it backwards, you're thinking, all right, what is a senior developer then? Mm-hmm. If I don't want my project to fail. But then the definition is that a senior developer is someone who has, you would think, failed a lot and knows why that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's almost this idea of working your way up through the, I don't know, there's that famous Michael Jordan quote or something like that about how, you know, you've missed all of these shots, but I kept on going and that's why I mm-hmm. became great. I'm totally mangled that quote. But I like that definition of saying someone who knows what can go wrong and what has gone wrong many, many times in their past. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of person you need. So it is... There is a little bit of time in there because you do need time to make all those failures. But at the same time, there's probably developers who've been working for 10 years writing the same CRUD app in PHP over and over and over again, who you could say, they could say, I've had a string of 10 successes. Every project has gone well, but they've built the same thing 10 times.
Code, exactly,
and as you said, a recruiter would say, oh, 10 years experience, you're a senior developer.
Yeah.
But then you don't have that experience with trying different kinds of things and getting the variety of experience and failing a lot and then knowing what kinds of things to look for. Of course, that said, if you did want to build that exact kind of CRUD app again and you hired that person, I'm sure things would go well. But if you just have some generic, pull it out of a hat, here's a project, who do I get on the team? That's not the kind of person you would want as again, this post says and Matt Briggs says, that's not a senior developer who you need in that role to look after things.
Yeah, and it's, you know, since it's the Canadian the All Canada show, I think we should use a Canadian analogy. And I know the story of Wayne Gretzky, for instance, would take a bucket of pucks out onto the ice, and he would hit the top right hand corner over and over and over again, right? Until it became muscle memory to him, right? So, and that's how he was able to, you know, when he was out playing games, be so good. And it was, he didn't really touch the puck all that often, but when he did, he really, it made it count, right? And I think using that analogy, when he talks about the senior developer here is they're not, they're more, they have more experience about why things work the way they do, and more about how to, you know, empower the younger members of the team or the more inexperienced members of the team to basically become better, and understanding that it's not just about making that same app 10 times, right? So
you just reminded me of Captain Kirk from Star Trek 2. Remember that? You know, when they're first facing Khan and they decide to enter the prefix code for the Reliant. Okay. And, you know, Savick, is it Savick who's in the Khan?
Oh, you're talking about the movie? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Okay, okay. Because there's another Khan, too, but he's, and same Khan, but he's
Star Trek II, yeah. The Wrath of Khan.
I know, yes, I get it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Oh!
1980-something, 1984, I believe. And, you know, that's the thing, like, that Savick says, you know, what are you even doing? Like, how does this work? And Kirk is like, you know, you have to understand how things work.
Yeah.
You're young. You don't understand this stuff yet.
Yeah.
And, like, so get me the prefix code for the Reliant. We're going to drop its shields and then kick its ass.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. That was experience over inexperience, I guess. And so he understands how...
Or experience over process, because Savick's whole point was there's a protocol to things, right?
That was her big hang-up.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, she's like the junior developer of Star Trek. And Kirk is like a senior engineer.
That's right. You give her a task, and she'll do it, but she may not understand why.
Or understand the big picture. Exactly.
Yep, there you go. Like, everything you need to know in life, you can learn from Star Trek.
Yeah, or hockey.
Yeah. Matt Briggs, we don't need anything from him.
Yeah.
He's already been taught.
Okay.
Now, do you want to do picks?
Sure, let's go around the table and see if we have any picks. So, Aaron, do you have a pick?
As it happens. So, I just acquired a new Mac. I have an iMac 5K sitting on my desk now.
And oh, cool, yes. I saw you tweet
really,
about that.
Really nice.
Mm-hmm.
lovely computer. So, one of the first things I did is install some software because I'm going to be running in a sort of dual situation. I'm going to have my laptop for when I'm away from my desk and, you know, obviously the iMac at my desk. But... In one way, you know, there's going to be situations where I'm going to need the stuff on my desktop, and so I've picked up Screens by Adovia, which is an app that I've been using for some time now, on my iPad in order to access another Mac that I have in my house connected to my TV.
Right.
So, when it came to this setting up my Mac, though, I wanted to get the Mac version of Screens, which would allow me to go from one Mac to view the screen of another Mac.
Yeah.
Now, this is distinguished... Sorry, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, why couldn't you just do that with the screen sharing built
I just wanted to say that. Why not use screen sharing? Because this screen sharing works fine inside of a network, but over the internet. Adovia has the Screen Connect service that it has. Mm. You create an account on their server, and then log in on all of your devices, and then boom, it just works. You open it up on your iPad or on your MacBook or wherever, and you can connect to any other Mac running the Screen Connect service.
Not like that Back to the Mac nonsense that we've used for years.
It is exactly like what Back to the Mac is supposed to be, except it actually goddamn works.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. So, highly recommended. It's not cheap, but worth it. It's like $25, I think, for the Mac version.
That's not expensive. Come on, Aaron, would yell at you if you said that.
I'm the first person to flip out over that. But, you know, as software goes these days, man...
Yeah.
It works very well. It's had good reviews as well from other publications.
Yeah.
And I have been using it on iOS for some time now, so it does work very, very well. So.
And it's Canadian made, isn't it?
Adovia? Are they there in Montreal?
I thought so.
Was that that guy Luke? Where are you? Tell me about your company. Adovia. They're in Montreal, yes.
All right.
There
lovely. Luke Vandal, yeah. And he was actually one of the guys involved in Singleton back when Singleton was around. Those are the days.
Yeah. So A question, though. So in my case, I tend to work off my laptop the majority of time, right? And for a while there, I was working on my iMac, and I would basically screen share to the Mac.
To the iMac.
To the portable Mac, right? Because I tend to be more portable for that's my sort of modus operandi.
What you're saying is that the majority of your stuff is on the MacBook.
Yeah, and so what I would do is I would use the screen sharing on the I would do a little bit of work, you know, some command line stuff or whatever on the iMac, but for the most part I would have a window open and I'd be actually sitting at a desk and using my Mac. Now I have an external, like an Apple Cinema display that I plug into my Mac, so my MacBook, so I have like a desktop kind of experience. But so in your case, you're the opposite. You're working from the laptop back to your desktop machine. Is that your?
That's the plan, exactly.
And so were you before exclusively working on the laptop, or?
Yeah, I have my MacBook Pro here. My 13-inch is now 3 years mm-hmm. old, and mm-hmm. I'm actually going to be replacing that as soon as my new MacBook 12-inch arrives mm-hmm. In the next couple weeks.
Right.
They're on significant back order. It's like 3 to 4 weeks.
Wow, really?
To get one nowadays. Black. Yeah. Please.
Oh, space gray. Space,
space gray.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mick approved space gray. So. I was going to ask you. So, how does the resolution of the Retina display manifest itself on the smaller MacBook display? Do you have any issues? Like, does it automatically downscale? And
yeah, like it runs in two modes. You can either look at the whole screen, you know, compressed onto the size of your 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro screen, or you can go 100%, and it just sort of follows your mouse as you scoop, sort of move around.
Yep.
Now, the one thing, I'm not nuts about that, but one thing I would love to see in this version, and the Mac version of this is actually the newest thing that Adovia ships. Like, they've, mm-hmm. they've been making the iOS version of this for some time, and I think the interactions on it are a little better.
Right.
Because the thing you can do on iOS is actually, like, you know, pinch to zoom, and zoom in and zoom out very easily using the pinch gesture on your iPad screen.
Yeah.
And you can't do something similar like that on the Mac. I think that would be a very quick fix for them that would really improve things in terms of interacting. Because, yeah, my iMac 5K screen on, you know, represented
huge.
On my... Yeah, huge. Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So big.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, I do something similar because I have an old VNC app. It's one of the first apps I installed on my iPad, and I to this day still use it occasionally to log onto one of my desktop machines and you know, move the screen around, and same sort of idea where, you know, you can look at it, you can pinch to zoom and make it bigger, and you can pan around, and then you have a keyboard that can come up and down as you need it, sort of thing, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, this is a VNC client and server setup, you know, that's what this is all about. But the thing that separates this from any other VNC app is just the niceties that come with it, right? That allow you to work with the host computer, you know, like passing the keyboard or the clipboard back and forth, for example. That's a big thing.
Oh, cool, yeah.
You know, the mouse pointer, you know, how you actually interact with it and how quick and responsive it is, even over the internet, as opposed to just on your local network. And, you know, they've got, you know, it's just very, very performant. It works very well.
Hmm.
You know, like management options that you can do, like giving you control of the other computer. It's just really, really smooth. It works very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've tried others and found myself frustrated by them, but screens is the one that seems to really get me. So check it out.
Yeah, for sure. I actually might do that because, like I said, I do. I'm in my back, going back to my support days. There was a tool I used to use called TeamViewer or something like that, and it allowed me to have a client install a piece of software on their computer, and then I could totally see what was going on their computer. I could, you know, drive around and manipulate. It was good when I was supporting both Mac and Windows, because it worked on both platforms. But now I use Messages or iChat, I guess. What do we call it now? Chat? Messages?
Messages.
And I do the screen sharing option through that, and it's just a matter of trying to get somebody to teach somebody how to set up an Apple ID on their machine. That's harder than it sounds, believe it or not.
No, it is tough, yeah.
But whereas, you know, the one-click installer was a bit easier way to do it. But yeah, so I've always sort of done the VNC thing and always looking for good clients for that kind of stuff, especially since I have several headless servers in the house as well, right? So
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, just like, you know, I archive my mail. I have a desktop Mac behind me, which, I, like I said, I used to work on a lot, but I very rarely work on it. But that's where I archive my IMAP account, right? So if I want to look at anything that's older than a year, I have to log onto that Mac over there. So I'll you know, use a VNC client to do that as well. Back to my Mac used to work pretty well, but it's been pretty lame for about 3 or 4 years now. So
I've never heard good things about that.
Well, you know, I there were times when I could be down in San Francisco or something and log onto a server here at home and grab a file. And, you know, one year, the first time I went to WWDC, I didn't realize that I needed to download an app onto my iPad. And iPad? Yeah, it must have been iPad. And I actually used VNC to log into my machine at home and tar up my backup and then send it down to my laptop overnight while my wife and I went and toured around San Francisco. And then the next day I was able to install the stuff because I forgot to bring my iTunes profile with me, right? Long story short. Anyway, that's cool. What's your name again?
It's Greg. His name is Greg. Greg, damn you.
All right. So, Greg, do you have a pick?
I do have a pick. It's the website applerSVP.com. And I know Tim just was talking about getting his grandkids interested in app development. This is not quite at that level, but it's a Apple thing. I should mention first, also, it's US only. And it's a program they have in their in-store. So you'd go into an Apple, you register, you go in, I think it's just a week or something like that, 3 days on the week. For a few hours, and you can bring in your 8 to 12 year old once they're registered, and they have two sort of classes, one for making a movie with iMovie. It says they cover original soundtrack and GarageBand, and then you edit a iMovie together, and then they have another one that covers interactive storytelling with iBooks, which I imagine is something about iBooks author on the Mac and making an interactive book with it. So it's an interesting kind of thing. Quick 1 week, I believe it's just a single week, kind of a summer camp thing. Get your kids into not coding, but this, it's a more creative thing, if we can say that, making movies and interactive books. So it's an interesting thing that Apple runs over the summer. Again, US only. You pick your store and then you register.
That's cool. Actually, my grandson Xavier is actually at a coding camp this week where he's learning Raspberry Pi stuff, right? So yeah, cool.
So he's coding in Python?
Is it Python or is it? No, it's probably, well, it's Linux of some type, right? So you think Python
is
the language?
It could be anything.
Yeah. Well, it could be, but I think like they tend to focus on Python when on the Raspberry Pi distributions.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. That is the new teaching language of the moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, we're not sure. It's a game-making, game-coding camp.
Oh, yeah, there's tons of game-coding stuff for Python.
Yeah, so he's
going to... I'm going to bet it's Python.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, it sure as heck won't be Bash, right?
No.
Never know.
Well, I was teaching him iOS a couple of weeks ago, so he was soaking that up. So,
how old is he?
He's going to be 12 in a couple of weeks. Yeah.
Awesome. So, my daughter, who's 11, has no interest whatsoever in coding. Just too bad.
Nothing, no, you haven't even tried like Arduino fashion stuff with her?
I've tried all kinds of stuff. Nope. Yeah. Mm-mm.
Well, you know.
She will not be manipulated.
Yeah, well, unfortunately for me, I don't think I have a choice with Xavier. He's just going to take over my business one of these days and fire me. Yeah.
What's your pick, Tim?
My pick, actually, well, I did have a couple of other picks, but this is a bit of a story. This afternoon, I was working away with Yosemite, and I all of a sudden had a problem with Mail, and I thought, I haven't restarted my Mac in a while, and Mail wasn't relaunching, and I thought, okay, well, let me restart the Mac, and, you know, got the new Yosemite startup with the little progress bar that goes across the screen, and it got halfway across and stopped. And I thought, oh, that can't be good, because one of the processes in starting up your computer is it checks your hard drive, or in this case, SSD. I killed that, tried it again, still nothing, right? And then, so then I fired up the resource thing. So needless to say, you know, finally got it booted from the resource disk or the repair disk, and it basically said that Apple will not repair this disk, right? And I have a couple of utilities I used to use, Disk Warrior as being one of them that I used in the past, and needless to say, that wouldn't work either. So I knew I was sort of in a position where I was screwed, but I keep a backup going on my computers all the time. I have a couple of Time Machine instances at home, and I have an app that I use through a Canadian company called Background Backup called Crash Plan that basically backs up my stuff to the Diefenbunker, again, another Canadian reference, in Ottawa. You know, might as well make use of it. Diefenbunker, for those Americans out there who don't know what it is basically our nuclear disaster thing for Parliament to, you don't have to sigh, Aaron, it's a part of Canadian history. It's, you know, when Parliament was under threat of nuclear war, they had to find a way to get, you know, the members of Parliament down into underground, and that's what they built this bunker under Prime Minister Diefenbaker. Anyway, so a friend of mine's company has storage space there where they have a bunch of servers, and that's where they keep the data, right? It doesn't go across the border, which is great for me. I like that. Anyway, so here I am. Mac is pooched. Got an app to deliver, you know, got to send an app build to the App Store today, right? So what am I going to do? So I'm going to start restoring my machine. So I needless to say, go and start restoring from Time Machine. And after wrestling with Time Machine for like a half an hour to try and get it to recognize stuff, it's going to take, you know, up to somewhere between 11 and 24 hours to restore the drive, right?
Is this over the network? The wired or wireless network?
This is 100 or gigabit Ethernet connected right to the Time Machine instance itself. I was wondering, though, you know, there's a USB port. I know you can use that for drives, but I wondered if you were able to connect to the Time Capsule directly. But, yeah, no, this is over a network, even with the gigabit. The problem with Time Capsule, if you don't know, is it's 1,000 tiny files, right? It's not like it backs up your system stuff. It backs up incrementally over a span of umpteen weeks or months or whatever. So putting back together your data takes quite a while. But this other program I use called Crash Plan, I keep a copy of it down. I have a copy that goes to one of my servers in the basement, and I have one that goes to the Diefenbunker, like I mentioned. And I'm, you know, basically it's the race against time, and that I'm able to get the files off of Crash Plan much faster than I can with Time Machine. So currently, tonight for me, my hero app is Crash Plan. So, and it's written by Code 42 in the States, and we're running a Canadian instance of it up here through background backup. That's my pick.
What do you mean by what is background backup?
Background backup.
I use Crash Plan myself, so yeah, I don't know.
So this is a Canadian company that a friend of mine owns in Ottawa, and basically they'll put devices in your network if you have like a company and you want to do, everybody wants to use Crash Plan. You basically pay for a seat on each machine you want to have in your network. And then, you know, there's a pricing plan of, you know, so much per month and so much per gigabyte. And instead of backing up to a store, like, you know, that with CrashPlan, you can choose other machines that have CrashPlan installed as a destination, right?
Yeah.
So I have a server downstairs with, you know, terabytes of space. So I back all of my computers to that one downstairs. But then, you know, if my house burns down, that's not going to help me, right? So my offsite backup thing is using CrashPlan through background backup, which is the Canadian exclusive reseller or something to that effect. What happens with that is we have a bunch of clients and as well as myself who use CrashPlan with a branded copy for IT Guy Technologies, and I get a report every night of all the successful backups of all of my clients, and, you know, so I can keep an eye on them even though they don't know they're being backed up, kind of thing, right? And if is it in the case of disaster, you can have all your data put on a disk and sent down to you and restored directly onto your computer, or in this case I'm restoring stuff over the internet.
Okay. So you're not using the Crash Plan service to back up to?
Not the American service. I'm using Canadian version of it, yeah.
I understand. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's what I like. I use Crash Plan, and I've got their family unlimited plan that I use.
Yep.
So I'm backing up to their servers with all of the computers on my network right now.
Right, yep.
Okay. The only thing I don't like about it is that it's a Java app, you know?
Yeah, and the version I'm running needs the old Java. That was the first challenge for me. Like, the first thing when you're installing is you install it, but then you have to install the Java environment. So it's been a bit of a pain that way. You're right, and I do run it on a couple of Linux servers as well, and it's very resource-intensive on Linux, I find, you know, so... Like, it opens up a whole lot of... It opens a node up for every single file on the system. And if you have, you know, gazillion... Like, in this case, we're doing an app server for one of our servers, one of our applications. And, for every file that a client uploads, you know, we have tens of thousands of users using our app. And, you know, each one of them has, like, you know, so many photos and so many chat sessions and all that kind of stuff builds up the space.
I guess.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a pick that way, and that's because of the Java piece, right? So, Yeah, and there's supposed to be updates coming for to resolve those kind of issues as well. But and Greg, you use Backblaze, I think, right?
I do use Backblaze, yeah.
Yeah, and what's your experience with that? Like, have you ever had to pull your butt out of a fire like I have with CrashPlant?
I have never, luckily, never had to do it so far. Yeah. I do still have Time Machine and Backblaze,
yeah,
and Dropbox, yeah, and another one. And I even had Tarsnap from a long time ago, another Canadian thing,
right,
based out in Vancouver. I think they use S3, the old S3, and I still have an account with them, although I've lost all the keys, so I haven't backed anything up. But they keep sending me invoices for the 1 cent a month that I use or whatever it is. But no, Backblaze, I guess, is my primary offsite backup for both of my computers, and I have never had to use it and restore anything. Although my brother-in-law uses it, and he has used the thing where you can go on their website, like, oh, you're out on vacation and you need that file from your computer, go online to your Backblaze and restore it. He has done that before. He said it works just fine.
Yeah. Well, while we were recording the podcast today, I was restoring my development folder. So I have Xcode on the machine that I'm recording on tonight, but I have a couple of deliverables I need to get out tonight. So after the show, I'll be firing up my development environment and carrying on with my work, right? So And then cursing the fact that I didn't push stuff up to GitHub.
Ooh, yeah, gotta do that. So, like, what happened with your drive, Tim? Like, did you just replace the drive, or
no?
Is it,
it's the SSD.
Reformatted it?
It's the SSD that came with, and and I'm always sort of very cautious about stuff. First of all, so I happen to have a 1 terabyte Seagate backup drive sitting in a closet. So I'm using that with a USB 3 connection.
Oh,
I'm restoring to that right now. Yeah, I know. I'd rather get my data back. I can see my data. It's all compiled together because you can't work off a Time Machine backup, because even though the stuff appears to be there, it's all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And then the same thing with CrashPlant basically, it creates little incremental archives of everything, and you kind of have to reassemble stuff. But I've done things like, I've had issues where somebody's gone in and done an update on a database and pooched every record on the database, and this is like in a MySQL instance, and been able to go back to CrashPlant, because I also back up my web servers with CrashPlant, and able to restore a database, which is a MySQL database, which can be a bit tricky, right? So I'd be able to go back 15 minutes, and CrashPlant runs every 15 minutes, whereas Time Machine runs every hour. And then the other issue with Time Machine, my pet peeve about them is not only the size of the just keeps growing and growing and growing, but how many times do I get the message that the Time Machine drive is busy and can't back up?
I've never had that.
Well, are you running Time Machine off of a network, or are you running it off of drive connected?
No, connected drive.
Yeah. Well, I have Time Machine on my server downstairs, and I have Time Capsules, right? And what happens is if the volume gets mounted on your Mac and there's some sort of hiccup on the network or whatever, it's Time Capsule thinks that, or Time Machine itself thinks that drive, that volume is still busy. Right, and then you can't restore, so you have to go and restart servers, or there's no elegant way out of it, right? So,
wow, yeah. That's no fun.
No, I mean, so if nothing else, Time Machine's better than nothing, right? And it's like you said, it's good if you have an external drive and you're habitual about plugging it in or making sure that it's always plugged in. I can't tell you the number of clients I've had over the years who've called me up and said, hey, my data's gone, and I like say, when's the last time you backed up? Oh, I think I backed up about 6 months ago. I'm like, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck to you, right?
Yep. I regard Time Machine. Time Machine is not a disaster recovery system.
No.
When your drive dies and you want to get things back. Like, it's really for pulling a file out of the past, like one version or two versions ago. That's when I use it, and that's why I value it so much. But that's why I have CrashPlant, and I also use SuperDuper. Sorry. So, are you familiar with SuperDuper?
The disk cloner.
Any of you?
Yeah.
The disk cloner. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm using that. So every time I've got like two external drives that I plug into my Mac, and on a regular basis, SuperDuper takes a clone of my drive. So if my startup drive dies, like Tim did today, I can literally just plug it in and start up off of that thing, and be off and running.
How often do you do the clone, though?
Well, now I've just got my iMac now, so I've got my SuperDuper clone, which I
copy every time I plug my my MacBook Pro into my hard drive. So whenever I come back to my desk, plug my MacBook Pro in, and that's when it makes a clone of my disk. So it would in effect be 2 to 3 times a day.
Okay.
I've also got a Time Machine volume that backs up on an hourly basis.
Yeah, I guess you have the registered Super Duper, so it does do that incremental thing. So I guess it's pretty quick if it runs that often.
Okay, well, let's wrap it up. And if people want to find you on the interwebs, Aaron, where would they look?
They'd look on Twitter at Aaron Vey, or go to my now newly operational battle station, magpievideo.com.
And Greg, if people want to find you on the interwebs, where would they look?
They should also look on Twitter. I'm Greg Heo. That's Greg H-E-O.
All right. Well, we'll see you guys next week. We'll say goodbye, and happy Canada Day.
Bye, everyone.
Don't forget to pet your moose.
That is not a euphemism for something.
If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There, you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the items we talked about on the show, as well as links to the apps on the App Store. If you like the podcast, please leave a comment on the website, or if you can, please write a review on iTunes. It really helps others find out about the show. You can also follow us on Twitter. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is at mtjc_podcast. If you'd like to support us, you can pledge any amount on patreon.com/mtjc. You can provide as little as a dollar a month. Any amount helps. However, you're free to do as you please. Thanks again for listening.
Okay, bye. And there's I was going to have like a discussion with Greg about his fabulous podcast he was just on. It was like totally awesome.
You should call me back, Tim.
So, Aaron, Greg, you were on this podcast. What's it called? The 5x5. Oh, yes. iOS.
Yes.
Yes. I love the name of that podcast. iOS.
I'll give you all this.
Aaron crazy.
Just cut that out. Whoa, something weird is happening.
What's that sound?
No, that's like an echo of like a laugh. I think he's about to fall offline.
Oh, all right.
It's kind of weird that you and I are still talking, though.
I know. Is he...
Let's listen in.
Oh, is that the last bit of his laugh? That's a weird sound.
It sounds like the last bit of his laugh.
I just thought it was like... Oh.
Are you there? Yeah. You're not. I think what we ought to do is dump this call and try again. Yeah, he can't even spell either. Okay, let's dump this call. We were just missing your pick and Tim's pick, right? Before we finish recording?
Yeah.
Crap.
You should just make some snarky comment about whatever the pick is, and then he can edit that in afterwards.
What is this? Apple RSVP, please. What the hell is that crap? Oh,
that was pretty good. I'll record that. I was recording that. Don't worry.
What is? No, seriously. What is this? Apple RSVP.
Like a camp
this
for,
is an Apple
camp for
site.
Kids. Not in Canada,
camp
unfortunately.
For kids. No. Well, then why are we even talking? Look at it's any store you like in the U.S. Damn. I don't know. What you know? Listen to this. Tim is typing. Oh my God, Tim's typing.
Oh.
So you can't hear me. Answer my question. Damn it. Can you hear us? The quality of this call sucked, but I don't know if that's Skype's fault. Okay, so he can't hear us either. Quarter after ten. Just as long as you're telling me that you didn't lose everything that...
No, I got it. I think I've got it, yeah. Let me just make sure.
I just love the thought of 2 weeks in a row going.
I'm recording the call, so don't worry.
Oh God, thank you. What are you using to do that?
I just started using Call Recorder, the one that everyone talks about.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Huh. Skype Call Recorder.
Skype Call Recorder. Yeah.
Started. And
I don't know if I like it as much, but oh jeez, that was loud. I just have it set to automatically record every Skype call ever, and then it makes a QuickTime file with two tracks, one for the, you know, the call side and one for your side. Right. But you can't change, I don't know, I want all the settings to change the quality and whatnot, which it doesn't give you.
Yeah. Mm.
But it's a good backup,
and you can't edit out, like, yeah, individuals. I think that's what Tammy uses, right? I think
so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You get two tracks, your track and everybody else is the way it works. Right.